This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 8th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 52nd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We have many things on today's show, some of them subtle, some of them funny, others mysterious, and one that's just hot. See if you can see what's what and which is which as we now do the bit, what's called the menu. First up, and with no little fanfare, I meet my hero, the critic, writer, filmmaker, maestro, Jonathan Meads.
Stayed in this most extraordinary hotel, and also near it were these neo-pagan totem poles. I became absolutely fascinated by this, and this is what I wanted to find out about them.
We'll also, on the week of the Frieze Art Fair in London, get our eyes attuned to the artistic by checking out a wonderful show from Spanish artist Greta Alfaro.
This building is looking like a haunted house, isn't it? And I, from the very beginning, even before knowing that I was going to work here, I knew this building, and I was impressed by the ghostly presence of it.
We'll also do The Strand, but in a set amount of clever moves, as we head to the World Chess Championships in London's Theatreland.
My first time in London, you know, and during the event I was very concentrated, so I didn't have time to see much, but it's a lovely city and I will definitely come back with my wife.
And the beautifully tuneful Sophie Delilah will be performing a live Midori House session of great new songs for you too. And that, my friends, is all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. First up, a track from our live session this week, courtesy of Sophie Delilah, a Parisienne in London with a neat line in soaring vocals, nagging hooks, and an exceptionally funky demeanour. Here she is with My Life Could Use a Remix.
My life could use a remix, but I don't know where to start. A little less pain, a little more sun in my heart. My life could use a remix, wish I knew where to begin. A little less madness, a little more truth. Get me out of the state I'm in. If my nights would have been shorter, or my drinks would have been weaker, if the parties ended before 2 or 3, if our dreams would have been smaller, or our words would have been truer, that second glass of Chablis, you'd still be here with me. What's wrong with me? I am my worst friend. What is wrong with me? How will this all end? My life could use a remix, but I don't know where to start. A little less pain, a little more sun in my heart. My life could use a remix, wish I knew where to begin. A little less madness, a little more truth. Get me out of the state I'm in. Had our share of magic moments, thought that they would last forever. Should've stopped the ride before it went too far. If our dreams would have been smaller, our words would have been truer. I'd be dancing in the street and know exactly where you are. What's wrong with me? I am my worst friend. What is wrong with me? How will this all end? My life could use a remix, but I don't know where to start. A little less pain, a little more sun in my heart. My life could use a remix, wish I knew where to begin. A little less madness, a little more truth. Get me out of the state I'm in, of that state I'm in. Oh, 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 oh. My life could use a remix, I don't know where to start. A little less pain, a little more sun in my heart. My life could use a remix, wish I knew it to begin. A little less madness, a little more truth. Get me out.
And that was My Life Could Use a Remix, live from Sophie Delilah here on Culture on Monocle 24. And there's more from the delectable Sophie Delilah later in the show. Here we go then. It's not often you meet the person that inspired you to want to nick a bit of them doing this, make a possible impersonation of them doing that, and call it your own career. But here on The Culture Show, things have come to a joyous pass. Jonathan Meads is a writer, journalist, critic, and filmmaker with an unmistakable style, that of the learned, stylized, hyper-subjective, straight-to-camera investigation of the strange, the wonderful, and the ordinary. Meads' new book is called Museum Without Walls, and it is about what he describes as the greatest free show. Places. We talked about the themes of the book, about his food writing, and about his films, but I started off with the subject of his accidental education in places, hanging out with his dad, who was a travelling biscuit salesman.
I would wander around these places aimlessly, just looking at everything, and you know, I'd look at as much at a kind of 1930s roadhouse as I would at a cathedral. I mean, I wasn't apprised of the kind of hierarchy of buildings and hierarchy of spaces, and I didn't know that such and such a street was meant to be very chic and another one was kind of was rough.
I wanted to ask you, in your architectural writing, this is a theme that runs through the book and through the TV films, whether you're sticking up for the ordinary, because you say that Britain sort of is at a loss sometimes because it always mistakes the exceptional for the typical. It wishes that everything was as beautiful as Salisbury Cathedral. You write about Le Corbusier and Amiens Cathedral and all these things that are regarded as masterpieces, but you do a lot of sticking up for the ordinary.
Well, there are various different kinds of ordinary. There's the kind of ordinary of banal volume builders with their estates, which aren't necessarily executive estates, just as their flats and necessarily luxury flats. And I think that an architect called Peter Alderton, who did rather beautiful jewel-like houses in mostly in Buckinghamshire and Hertfordshire, once said what one needs is not more that's exceptional but a better standard of ordinariness. And it's something I very much believe, that Britain would be hugely improved by volume builders building stuff in the way that they do in Spain and Holland, which I think are currently the leaders in architectural design in Europe. I mean, if one goes across the border from Biarritz, Saint-Jean-de-Luz into Spain, it's like going to a different planet, because, I mean, French building is even more banal than British. But you get into Spain, going to, you know, 20 kilometres down towards San Sebastian, and they're wonderful buildings everywhere. And they're just ordinary buildings, but they're new buildings, but done with a kind of a brio and a kind of inventiveness. And inventiveness and imagination don't cost anything.
There's a couple of people that you focus on in the book, Zaha Hadid and Norman Foster. And I wondered how it is looking at the work of these architects who get these huge commissions, who are star architects, and I wondered how different it is looking at their work in comparison to something like Marsh Court. Is it the difference between listening to something by Beethoven and listening to something by Buddy Holly? I mean, I wonder for your eye whether there is something.
Well, I kind of like a lot of Beethoven and I like a lot of Buddy Holly, but I think that the thing is with an architect like Foster is that there are several Fosters, and there's kind of a lot of it is some kind of diffusion line, which is a huge, you know, it's a huge industry. And I suppose you don't expect Henry Ford to have made every car that came off the production line. You can't expect Norman Foster to design every building that enormous practice does. I mean, I remember seeing the Willis Faber Dumas building in Ipswich, not knowing about it. I mean, I just went round a corner going to see a game at Ipswich Town, who in those days were quite a good football club, seeing this extraordinary thing and thinking, God, what is this masterpiece from the 1930s doing here? And it wasn't. I mean, it was brand new, but it looked like something by Owen Williams, who did the Daily Express buildings in Fleet Street and Manchester and Glasgow and used black vitrolite. It looked just like one of his things. I thought, why don't I know about this? I was in my 20s then, and you don't know as much, and you still have a kind of retaining that air of curiosity and the potential to be amazed is much easier at that point.
You bit of happy ignorance.
Yeah, ignorance is something you desperately try and overcome. Yeah. But you
wish you could have it back.
At the same time, you do.
How fast do you have to walk to notice all these things?
I'm a very, very slow walker. I mean, I hold up people on pavements.
One of those.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things which I rue about London is that most of London has pavements which are far too narrow. And everyone's rushing around the whole time. Everyone's so busy. What are they doing? And there's that sort of northern, you know, the kind of Protestant work ethic kind of expressed in the streets, you know, that you've got to hurry to get to the next appointment.
A lot of walking sideways is done to get past people.
Yes, yeah.
Like you. Looking up all the time.
Well, I look up. I look every. I mean, I do take an absolute delight. I mean, it's what you know that it's a title which has been used before. Museum Without Walls. It was used by Malraux, but I mean, for me, it is a great free show. I mean, just looking at buildings and at spaces between buildings and at trash. Well,
I wanted to ask you about the films since you started in the late 80s with the films for the BBC. The look is obviously something that can be glanced. I mean, you need to glance past a television screen to notice that it's you on the television, your signature look of your glasses and suits and suede shoes tramping across anything from forest floors to mud to city streets. How did that construct come about? Because I know that you studied at RADA rather than at university. Is that how much Jonathan Meads is on the television, how much Jonathan Meads in quotes is on the television?
Well, the Hugh Crutwell, who was the principal of RADA, said to me when I left RADA, I think you'll be a really successful character actor. I said, well, great. He said, when you're middle-aged. And many years later, he said to me at dinner one night, do you remember what I said? And I said, yes, of course I remember. Not like you forget. And he said, the one thing I got wrong was that I didn't know the character was going to be called Jonathan Meads. And he knew very well that what I do is a turn, a performance, and it is a construct, it's an artifice. And I guess it came about in a way because the films I make are extremely artificial.
They're absolutely subjective.
Yes, and they're kind of reinventions of places. I mean, we use what is actually there to make something which is effectively fictional. I mean, it's like a kind of fictions without a character or with just one character, me, in it. They have much more to do with kind of one-man shows and performance art than they do with any kind of documentary tradition. And, I mean, everything I do is extremely rehearsed. The only kind of spontaneity I like is rehearsed spontaneity.
Yeah.
When we shoot, we get the shot and that's it. We don't hang around and think, well, we could improve it by doing this or that.
On the theme of TV, I wonder why the food, the certain specialties about junk food and vegetarianism and things, I wondered how more food never made it into your television programmes.
I didn't want to do food on telly. I think food on telly is grotesque. I mean, right. The standard, these sort of moron chefs, I mean, they're equaled only by moron footballers, I think.
Before we go, I'd like to take it back to the book. I wanted to ask about Birmingham, the surprising beauty of Birmingham. I promised our foreign editor from Birmingham that I'd ask you this as well. And it's one of my favourite chapters in the book.
Birmingham has, if it has a reputation at all, it's rather poor. It's very overlooked. The film I made about it was called Heart Bypass, because, you know, the heart of England, but it's bypassed and no one actually goes and looks at Birmingham, which is, to me, one of the most attractive cities in Britain. There's several reasons for this. It's the only city, I think, with the possible exception of Glasgow, where the arts and crafts movement succeeded in working urbanistically rather than suburbanistically. I mean, most arts and crafts buildings you'll find in, you know, places like the precursors like Bedford Park, and you'll find them scattered around in Birmingham, places like Bourneville, which are, I think, but in the centre of Birmingham, there's a great deal of arts and crafts stuff, which is absolutely unique. I mean, there is nothing else like it. It's red brick. It pays some kind of lip service to its Victorian precursors. And Birmingham suburbs, they adhere to the cliche of suburbs being green and leafy. Yeah. And there are arts and crafts houses which have the earliest integral garages of anywhere in in Britain. There's other fascinating stuff, like the biggest allotments, a patch of allotments in Britain. There are listed prefabs from the 1940s. And, I mean, a lot of very, very strange stuff. It's a very, very rich place.
Well, Jonathan, for the time being, thank you very much. Jonathan Meads, author of Museum Without Walls and many others. And the new film is on Essex.
The new film is on Essex, yeah.
So we'll have to possibly come in and talk about Essex again. I think that might be a phone call to Marseille away.
Yeah.
No one's ever phoned anyone in Marseille to ask about Essex, but we're going to see if we can do it. Jonathan Meads, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Brr. Why is it getting cold? It must almost be time for freeze. We get looking arty after this.
Monocle 24 is growing. We're proud to introduce The Stack, a new program on air every Saturday. This lively one-hour show is a celebration of the print media, exploring the best in periodicals, niche journals and newspapers, and talking to people from around the world who are pushing the sector forward and shaping the media landscape. Running on Saturdays at 10 a.m. UK time and repeated on Sundays, the show is an intimate conversation around a coffee table stacked with interesting magazines and newspapers from around the globe, hosted by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. That's The Stack, every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. UK time, repeated on Sundays and available online. Brought to you in association with J.Crew.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where it's Freeze Week. Here in London, the art world gets to put on its best frock, practice its air kissing, and don its Joe 90 glasses and make like an art dealer. Our culture show Entourage will be popping into each gallery to see what's cooking, and we'll be broadcasting live from the fair this week in the form of special art-themed editions of Midori House. And then the fruits of our labours can be lapped up next week on a special Freeze-centric culture show. But we wanted to provide you, dear listener, with a couple of little freeze treats to whet your appetite today. First up, it's a vital part of a piece of art, but its aim is often to remain invisible. Much will be made over the coming days about what's on show at the Freeze Art Fair, but perhaps very little will be said about the frames that surround them. Emma Nelson explores the art of choosing the right surrounding.
In the upstairs of a 1940s building in the East End of London, a number of homemade films is projected onto a back wall. But blocking the view is a series of wooden pillars and beams which crisscross the space. They've been installed by the British conceptual artist Liam Gillick. The gallerist, Maureen Paley, who's exhibiting Gillick's work, explains the thinking behind them.
In entering the space, you also didn't just view his film, but you interacted with it. So as you move into the space, you're able to see more and more of the piece and sit down and actually watch it. But he also wanted it to be that you were aware of the whole space when you entered it, so that you were thinking about the architecture, thinking about the gallery, thinking about the full structure of the work.
However self-conscious, it's an effective way of making you think about framing, a practice whose success is generally judged by its invisibility. Maureen Paley describes the recent evolution of the frame.
In the 60s and 70s, people were framing things often in very simple ways, and frames were used extensively, but kind of not as much part of the work. Then into the 80s, it moved into kind of huge production values being introduced and people extending the frame to become almost sculptural and to become part of like a larger installation. Then showing Wolfgang Tillmans, I was very intrigued because Wolfgang decided very, very much in the late 80s, early 90s, that he was going to present work unframed. And very much in contradiction to the kind of heavy framing devices of the 80s, he was going to put work up with a kind of Scotch magic tape. Some people were uncomfortable with it, but became more comfortable with it. And he actually created almost a lightness of being. What's interesting now, many artists are interested in the architectural, Many artists are interested in citing their work. And so the frame becomes both sculptural and incidental. When works are insensitively framed, they can actually detract from the work itself, and one has to be extremely careful about that.
So what can be done when an artwork is wrongly, or in Maureen's words, insensitively framed?
I'm Tim Sayer, and I collect a lot of art. Come into the bedroom, as they say, and have a look at my Perspex boxes.
Tim knows a thing or two about getting it right.
A frame, when I buy a picture, is no problem because you can always rip it off. This large abstract that we're looking at now arrived on the top of the artist's car. It had an enormously cumbersome frame on it, which he'd done himself. Poor old chap, he'd spent hours on it. And as soon as he was out of the front door, I ripped it off and put this tiny, narrow little frame on it because I felt his frame completely wrecked it. A frame can be so distracting. It can catch your eye, it can be the wrong colour, it can contrast very badly, it can clash with a work of art and completely put you off looking at it.
Do you think that certain frames only suit certain periods of art?
Very rarely. I think you can cross periods. I don't think it works. I've got a little small 17th century print. It's got a very ornate frame on it, but that actually works very well. But I could never put that frame on anything any more modern than what it's on.
This challenge of framing the old with the new is something the organisers of Frieze London have had to address, albeit on a far larger and more prominent scale. The fair, which has become a touchstone for contemporary art, is famed for redesigning its space every year. This year, though, there's a new addition to the Frieze fold. Frieze Masters has set up camp on the same site to feature works from the ancient era right up to the 20th century. At their offices in Shoreditch in London, I asked Frieze's co-director Matthew Slotover how they took on the challenge of creating a brand new frame for their new direction.
There's two or three things that I'm hoping will make the difference. One is the actual architecture of the fair. So using Annabelle Seldorf, who's a great architect living in New York, what she's done is to limit the palette of the walls, for instance, in the fair. So we did think, could we just do white walls, but that would be very tough for a lot of the historical galleries who like to put things on deep kind of reds or blues or greens. But what she said was, okay, you can have colour as long as it's grey. So there's four shades of grey and there's a white, and that will be the colour palette for the walls at the fair. We haven't had anyone say, I'm not going to do your stupid grey walls.
But let's not forget the character at the heart of all this. The framer. Any visitor to Frieze, or indeed any of the major modern art galleries in London, will probably have had his or her gaze shaped by this man.
My name's Mark Derbyshire. My company's Derbyshire Limited. We're picture framers. Framing does two things, really. It makes the artwork look good, but it also protects the artwork long term.
Mark explains the process of creating a frame.
You sit down with the client, whether it's a collector or a gallery, and just discuss how they see the frame and really come up with a good recommendation for each artwork.
The contents of Mark's workshop have been described as the most accurate barometer of the state of the London art market. They also run like a who's who of the young British artists movement. Not only does Mark know exactly who's buying what and when, he also enjoys a rather discreet privilege.
I get to see artwork early. Even before it's got onto the walls of the gallery, I've had the opportunity to buy, barter, swap artworks for framing, and I've been doing so for 20 years and managed to make a collection of over 200 works.
So the four contributors, the dealer, gallerist, collector and the framer himself, must enjoy a certain interdependence or complicity. It's a little like the sides of a frame, perhaps. At the centre, however, remains one thing, a love for the work itself, as Mark Derbyshire concludes.
I'm interested in art before I'm interested in framing, really. So that's what drives me.
So let's have a taster of what's happening around Frieze. Last week, I walked to a windswept, disused goods warehouse in the not-quite-yet-developed bit of London's King's Cross to meet the quite beautifully dressed Greta Alfaro, a Spanish artist on a mission to explore what might once have been happening in this very building in Edwardian times. Greta made a one-to-one scale model stage set of the stock office and had rats run all through the place, rats with cameras on their backs. Here's what Greta and I talked about when she showed me around her show entitled A Very Crafty and Tricky Contrivance.
So this the Fish and Coal building was built as an office building in the 19th century related to the King's Cross station. They were dealing with the administrative tasks related to the coal trading into London. So when I stepped into it, I thought it was an amazing place and I would love to do something that's site-specific and that's not only in the building but working with the building. So what I did is I reconstructed an office of the Edwardian times inside one of the rooms of the building. What I did is I filmed this, so you don't see it. You will step into that room, but you will see it through the eyes of a rat, because the furniture are removed, the paperwork is removed, and you'll see a big projection screen where you will see a video piece that's around 20 minutes long, and it has been filmed by a rat. I have attached mini video cameras to the back of rats, and they have been filming around while a group of Edwardian clerk workers are going on with their daily tasks.
So we've come out of the dark room, which is a huge video installation with a couple of bench seats. We're invited to sit and watch this Edwardian office, this fictional Edwardian office, from the point of view of a rat. And it's quite an affecting thing to be watching the camera that's stuck on a rat's back. I felt a little bit seasick in that dark room watching those rats. Were you surprised at the sort of patterns that the rats took and where they went around this room?
Well, it's always surprising when you work with animals. You have to be open for the unexpected because you cannot control them. And, well, maybe you can, but it's not what I'm looking for when I work with animals. So I'm really pleased with how it looks because it adds something to the ghostly presence of this building and the fact that we cannot access the upper or lower floors and you are kept in this kind of curiosity of knowing more and then just being offered glimpses of it.
I'm kind of listening out for an eek. Oh yeah, there's one on the desk.
In the show, what you get is fragments, corners of the room, kind of a still life photographs, where you see the office furniture and everything, and then it's full of rats. It's as if workers have left, and the only thing that is around are rats.
Well, they look like the office workers left the room a long time ago. They have a look of decay about them, and they're crawling in rats. What's going on in this picture? Because the light is very much like when people do reconstructions of ghost. Sort of haunted houses. It looks very much like a haunted house.
This building is looking like a haunted house, isn't it? And I from the very beginning, even before knowing that I was going to work here, I knew this building, and I was impressed by the ghostly presence of it, because this area is being all renewed, everything is looking kind of glossy, you know? And then you have all this very hectic city centre right by King's Cross and Pancras. Suddenly you step some metres behind the stations, and then you get this very weird building by the canal with all these boarded windows, and it's something it seems to be standing there from the past, a very, very weird presence. And yeah, I wanted to reflect that in this project.
Your other work's all photographic, and this is all about sort of the camera, but moving, the camera moving around quite frenetically, and the camera's not under your control because it's on the back of a rat. What's it like to relinquish control of the camera?
Let's see. I wouldn't say that my work is photographic in that sense, because I don't consider myself a photographer. I work with very different media. I create these installations that are created to be filmed. Sometimes they are created to be enjoyed by the audience, but usually they are created to be filmed because they cannot work if the audience is there. Yeah, it is the first time in which I am not in control of the camera. In my work, I always play, or I like to play with this fight between chaos and control. I like it in relation to the way we work in our societies, but also in the way things are done in terms more technically. So in the previous works we had animals doing what they want, like the piece with the vultures, for example. But in this case, yeah, I'm not in control of the camera. The camera is not fixed. It's the first time I'm working with this. And yeah, in a way, the photographs are showing, as we said before, more like a human vision of things, and just pointing at the rats in a very different way from the human point of view, so that you can rationalize a little bit what you are seeing in the film, probably.
It seems to me there's a lot of the idea of decay in this work. And we're here in a sort of old goods shed in King's Cross. We're looking out at the regenerated King's Cross, but we're not in the regenerated King's Cross. We're in the old bit, the scruffy bit. How did you go about looking for this space?
Okay, so I was offered to do this show by the Genesis Foundation, and the curator, Flora Fairbairn, worked in searching for buildings. So the first building I got offered was like a normal exhibition hall, and I felt like I would like something a bit more challenging or more special. So the second option was this, and I really felt in love with this place. I thought I could really, really work on it. And because of this project being a commission, I really thought doing a site-specific work would be the most suitable and the thing that I found more interesting and challenging. Regarding the decay, I'm very interested in decay in all my work, and I've been looking at it from very different perspectives, like looking through Baroque and still lifes and Vanitas, for example. But I think my interest in decay is very linked to the way I perceive our society, and also the way the media perceive our society. And I think we are in this moment where Western society is decaying, and we are having all these huge crises that are not only economical crises, but also social crises. And working with an office and an office building, for me, is very symbolic because it's very representative of the way our societies work.
That was Greta Alfaro talking me through her latest show, a very crafty and tricky contrivance, which is on in King's Cross's Fish and Coal building right now. And you'll be able to hear all of our special highlights from Frieze Masters and Frieze itself in our one-year anniversary culture show next week here on Monocle 24. Still to come in part two, we'll hear more from the jazz pop beauty Sophie Delilah's little Midori House session and get to hear her reflections on her tunes. We'll pop down to Simpsons in the Strand to partake in a spot of the World Chess Championships. Plenty to enjoy, my dear old pals. And here's Sophie Delilah again, the woman with the biggest barnet in pop. Here from her Midori House session is What Did I Do?
I'll remind you of a girl you used to know. She used to wait for you to call and say hello. Now she's gone, ways that you don't understand. Guess that's high. You don't want us to be friends. Oh, what do we do? What do we say when the heartache's all over you? If only we knew, would it be easy to face what we're going through? You wanted me then, but you don't want me now. Not as a friend, and you won't tell me why. I wanna fix it, but I don't know how. Tell me, what did I do to hurt you so? To hurt you so? You say no way, you are trying me again. It's not necessary for me to pretend that I know I'll see you down the line. That one day remind me of a friend of mine. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
only we knew, would it be easy to face what we're going through? You wanted me then, but you don't want me now. Not as a friend, and you won't tell me why. I wanna fix it, but I don't know how. Tell me, what did I do
And after her rather marvellous session, I sat down with Sophie to hear more about her music and her muse.
I grew up listening to a lot of soul music and funk because my parents really love that kind of music. So Stevie Wonder obviously has been, you know, my guide for all that type of music. Yeah, I've listened to, of course, all kinds of music growing up, but a lot of electronic music. So I tend to incorporate it almost naturally.
Yeah. With the electronic music.
Yes.
It's a big French thing. You grew up in Paris, but you're now based in London.
Yes.
Is that something that you sometimes play with a bigger band, with the electronic stuff, or you do it, or you mess around?
Yeah, we do. I mean, with the full band, like, yeah. Obviously here we did a smaller sort of cozy acoustic set, but with the band there's more technology going on stage.
More tech.
Yes.
Flashing lights?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay.
But I'm still working on the actual show, so that's to come. But I'm going to have some surprises.
Oh, yeah.
I can't really reveal it yet.
And how does that work? When you're experimenting with what's going to be in a live show,
mm-hmm.
It's not just the music, as you said, there's all the other stuff. There's
yes.
more tech. What happens? What's the plan for that? I mean, just practice make perfect when it comes to that thing?
Yes, I think you need to prepare a lot. I mean, I'm still in the stages of preparing because I've, you know, only done one gig with these songs, and it was very, very early on. It's still very early on, so I'm actually going on tour soon, still with the acoustic thing. So I've got lots of ideas. It's good to have a team that helps you realize those ideas.
Yeah.
But yeah, I want to make big things. So that takes time.
And they're the sort of songs that seem like they belong in a bigger place. They belong. Dancing needs to be done, some of those songs.
Yeah, I think so. I saw you moving your foot.
So we're going to go back. And then we were back in Paris, weren't we? We were talking about where you grew up. And the records around the house and that sort of thing. And then you went to Berklee School of Music.
Berklee, yeah.
Berklee School of Music.
Yeah.
In Boston.
Yes.
What happened there? Does that help you to become a better musician physically, or does it help you compose music?
It's hard to say because, you know, I went there just after high school, basically. So I was still, you know, learning.
Mm.
I'd done a lot of classical piano and I was already doing a lot of production. And so when I arrived, I didn't think I was going to learn about that because I already knew how to do it. So I was more focused on performance and practicing instruments. I think the writing comes as well, but it's so personal. I don't think you can really learn to write a song in a classroom.
Because it's sort of, at least lyrically, I think from listening to the titles of your songs and you speaking in between them, some of them are quite personal. Or are you just pretending?
I'm just pretending. No, I'm not. They're all real.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm a formula songwriter. I need to be able to relate to it, or maybe the story of a friend. It needs to be real somehow. It can't be totally made up.
And what happens at someone like Berklee? There's obviously lots of fertile musical minds and sort of virtuoso players, I'd imagine. Is it quite a competitive environment, or are people sort of going, oh, that sounds great, but when you do it in G?
It is both. It's competitive, and then there's a huge network of people. You're surrounded with musicians the whole time, so obviously you learn a lot, and everyone was super friendly and help you out. I guess the most competitive department was probably the vocal department, because there's, you know, every year there's like that singer's showcase thing.
It's
very
like
privileged
now.
You know, yeah.
Exactly.
And I learned a lot. I discovered jazz over there, because before going there I really didn't know much about jazz, jazz gospel, world music. So it was really about discovering what the world of music was offering.
And then gigging around, you obviously do your own stuff, and you've got the album, and you're writing these new songs which you're playing for us today.
Yes.
But also, you've supported people. When you support bigger artists and things, how does that work? Is that, do you genuinely kind of get to showcase your songs in front of a bigger audience, or are they kind of queue for the toilets and in the beer queue?
No.
Because presumably, because especially with your type of music, that's the kind of music that needs attention.
Yeah, no, right? I think all the big sort of support slots I've had were very good, because people were actually here in the room. I got a chance to showcase my music in front of a lot of people, and that was amazing. I love performing anywhere, you know, and it's always different, and that's the beauty of it. You have to readjust, adapt yourself to wherever you're playing.
Yeah.
And so obviously supporting like Lionel Richie or Jamiroquai, it was huge opportunities, and it was amazing.
And what about gigging? You're touring now. Roughly where will you be and when?
Next week, I'm going on a UK tour supporting Ben Montagu.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be roughly six shows around UK.
Is it nice, or is it slightly, do you get a bit scared when you walk into a thing and you're going, right, okay, we've got to do, when a place is a tricky shape or it's in a place you haven't been to before? Does that bother you? Because you seem like a very natural performer.
It does not bother me. I just have to centre all my thoughts on the show and not really care about the size of the room or, you know, then once the audience is in the room, that's who you focus on.
Yeah.
And that's it, really. Nothing else really counts. I think I automatically adjust
kaboom
myself.
You're
yeah,
in the zone.
Otherwise, there's too much worry, because you'll never perform in a place that you've been to most of the time, unless you, you know, you've got years of
you're
being
habitual.
A big artist. Yeah. Of course, you go back to festivals all the time, or to the O2 or things like that.
Right.
But you know, for me, there's still a lot of new venues I haven't been to, so I'm fine with that. I love it.
Well, don't go looking at anyone else's shoe, because it might not be keeping as good time as mine. That's what I'm saying. For the time being, Sophie Delilah, thank you so much for
thank
your
you
Glory
very
House
much.
Session and for joining us for a chat.
Thank you for having me.
That was Sophie Delilah chatting with me here at Monocle 24, where you're only listening to The Culture Show with Robert Bounds. Spot of chess, anyone?
The October issue of Monocle says hola to the world, as we look at how speaking Portuguese is becoming the rising language of trade, diplomacy, sport and culture. We travel through the Lusophone world, from Brazil to Angola, the Azores to Mozambique, to cover the people making their mark in everything from politics to soap operas.
In the design section, we visit the Porto studio of Álvaro Siza, and we soak up the autumn sun in a Spartan rural lakeside house in the heart of the Swedish countryside.
In the edit section, we take you to Coruche, a 30-minute drive from Lisbon, where we harvest the best cork in the world for our specialist feature. We also hop on a plane to Amsterdam in search of tasty, organic and seasonal recipes at local favourite De Kaas restaurant.
The October issue of Monocle also includes our annual style survey that delivers you a head-to-toe vision of the trends to watch. It's all on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world, or as they say in Portuguese,
Monocle, sempre de olho no mundo.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. There was a stir in London last week. A subtle one. A ripple of excitement wobbled through the air, disturbing just for a minute the rooks and pawns of the world chess players' chessboards. That's right, the World Chess Championships were back in London. We sent Ben Jay down to the event to meet some key players, including Andrew Paulson, chief exec of Aegon, who owned the commercial rights to the event.
Thank you all for coming tonight. Thank you for being here from the beginning. Carol, can you...
When I first took over chess, I realized that I needed to figure out why it hadn't been working for the last 50 years. So I talked to lots of people and poked my nose around a little bit, and I found that there were some very simple fixes. First of all, you take it out of Siberia, you put it in great venues, in great cities, you create a schedule that's more or less predictable, that people can plan ahead and media can wrap its head around. So I see that what I have to do now is slowly bring back to chess all of the aesthetic apparatus all the ceremony and the ritual and the sacred that has been leached out of it.
All right, so tied for 11th, 12th, is Hikaru Nakamura and Anish Giri.
Okay, I'm Anish Giri. I'm from Holland, 18 years old. Unfortunately, this time I didn't do very well. I lost 3 games and drew all the others. And somehow, normally speaking, you get a lot of chances to, you know, to win some games. But here, I didn't really have any chances after round one.
With regards to when you're playing, the design is changing of the way that room is laid out, and they were talking about giving iPads out, so they'll have you strapped up to like heart monitors and things, so they can look at how you're faring as you go. How does that make you feel as a player? Is it quite an exciting concept?
I think it's just pretty cool, you know, as a player as well as for a spectator. I mean, I think maybe some players could be slightly uncomfortable, you know, with those devices like, I don't know, the heartbeat rate, stuff like this. But I think generally people are looking forward to this kind of new stuff, and myself, I'm really excited.
My name is Daniel Weil, partner of Pentagram.
Describe for me this particular room that we're in now and how you've designed it.
It's very much decorated in a Regency style, so very frilly, very ornate. So the language is a very traditional classic language, I would say English classic, but if we think that chess is a game seeped in history, it has a history that goes hundreds of years, the idea of really setting up what it is, an historical room, with a very modern frame is a great contrast, because what we want is to take this use and benefit from his historical heritage of chess and build a much more angular, more modern approach to the environment in which players play.
Is it a difficult thing to do, to design globally? Because obviously there's different markets, there's different preferences, etc.
I mean, there hasn't been a means of organizing it and bringing it together and say, this is the standard. What we're creating is the gold standard of how it should be done, not just the rules of the distance between the player and the spectator and the amount of light that should be on the table. But we're creating an expectation of environment. The surprise will be the setting. So in this case, we have an historical one. In other cases, we'll have a much more modern one. So I'm looking forward to prove the design in the different situations.
In the first place, also with 7 points, but first place on tie breaks is Vasilin Topalov.
Vasilin Topalov from Bulgaria. I must say I'm a little bit lucky, because before the last round I didn't really believe that I had a chance to win. I was quite lucky in my game, and then the other games also went good for me, so I was the symbolic winner.
And how are you feeling now? You've had a few hours to let it sink in.
I went to the National Gallery a little bit to see some painters, but my first time in London, you know, and during the event I was very concentrated, so I didn't have time to see much, but it's a lovely city and I will definitely come back with my wife.
There's recently been a lot of investment. How does that affect you as a player? Is that exciting for you?
Well, let me tell you, when I was a world champion, from my opinion, the situation was better. Prize money was higher and even the level of organization was very good. It dropped the last couple of years, so I hope that you will become as it was before.
That was the winner of this year's World Chess Championship, Bulgarian Grandmaster Vasilin Topalov, ending that little skit there from the World Chess Championships in London. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be celebrating a year of being on air with a Frieze Art Fair special, among other things. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilbao, and Holly Fish glued the whole thing together like an expert surgeon, but with matchsticks and glue. Time for one final song this week from her Midori House session. This is Sophie Delilah with If I Should Die Tonight. Thanks for tuning in.
It cries in my heart like it rains in the city. I don't need your help. I don't want your money, 'cause I'm gonna get going and make myself pretty. And now's the time to get down, 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 down. I love the way we move, and we got nothing to lose. Oh, if I should die tonight, I'm gonna end it on the high. Gonna wear that disco light, I'm gonna rock the dance floor. If I should die tonight, I'm gonna live. I roll down the street now in my bright red Chevy. Put on my lipstick, it's time to get ready. And I wanna get high, crank the rock steady. It's my favorite song, the radio is playing it right now. I love the way we move, well, we got nothing to lose. Oh, 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 oh. If I should die tonight, I'm gonna end. It rains in the city. I don't need your help. I don't want your money, 'cause I'm gonna get going, make myself a pretty. Now is that time to get down, 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 down.